The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. After the leak of the draft decision in the Supreme Court case Dobbs that could result in the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we see threatening protests targeting the homes of our Supreme Court justices. The administration responds.
I don't have an official U.S. government position on where people protest.
We'll take a closer look.
Section 1507 makes it a federal crime to picket or protest outside the homes of judicial officers.
If that draft opinion is in fact released as a majority opinion, what should we expect?
Tens of millions of Americans are going to realize that the left has lied to them for half a century.
Feeling the heat on inflation, the president addresses the nation.
The mega Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress that you're going to will hand power over to them.
Economist Stephen Moore responds.
Really a dreadful speech.
Plus, Ukraine holds its ground while Putin signals a long fight.
Putin has no regard for human life.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my radio program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and now on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And please follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We will begin with the fallout from the calculated leak of the Supreme Court's draft majority opinion in the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health case. It's the case that could well overturn Roe v. Wade. This Dobbs decision, if the draft becomes final, and I hope it does, is correct and necessary for the Constitution to get out of the deep woods that Roe and the subsequent Casey decision from 1992 thrust it into. The activists, at least on the left, have already been activated. Yes, there are protests in front of the court, but those activists have also targeted the homes and families of the justices themselves. Outgoing White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made light of it.
I don't have an official U.S. government position on where people protest.
But it's a breach, and not just of democratic norms. It is a violation of federal law. Here's Andrew McCarthy with Kevin McCullough on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
There is actual federal U.S. code that addresses not protest speech in general, but specifically targeting justices of the Supreme Court. Tell me what federal code, U.S. Code 1507, is actually all about.
Section 1507 specifically makes it a federal crime to picket or protest or parade, as the expression goes. I think parade is an interesting expression for a reason I'll come to in a moment, but outside the homes of judicial offices. It prohibits other things as well, but it speaks specifically to what's been going on the past few days with the protests that have occurred outside the homes of Justice Kavanaugh, Chief Justice Roberts, and last night I understand from the reporting I saw this morning, Justice Alito's home. So yeah, that's a federal crime, and it's an obvious one.
Well, who would be responsible then for holding those people accountable that are committing said crime?
Yeah, that would be the United States Department of Justice. And I would point out that in hundreds of cases, Kevin, in connection with the Capitol riot, they have charged people with parading. In other words, you have lots and lots of cases against people who were not accused of doing anything in the way of destroying property or intimidating or obstructing or assaulting police officers, who just basically wandered around in a place they weren't supposed to be. And the Biden Justice Department not only didn't hesitate, but wanted everybody to know that they were charging these people and throwing the book at them. And what they charged them with is parading.
These are wildly, in many cases, out of control people that are violent in their tone. I was even just taken aback by just the protests that occurred in churches across the country over the weekend. I mean, it just seems like the group that is pretty much realizing that they're probably going to lose this opinion are not handling that reality very well. And Andy, there may have been a different approach to this if, say, this had been decided 20 years ago. But in the tribalized, kind of tone-deaf, all-power-seeking day in which we live in, this is strangely, curiously dangerous in my mind that people are acting this way even before an official opinion has come down.
Yeah, well, you know, look, Kevin, again, if we compared it to the Capitol riot, you know, President Trump was impeached for what they called incitement to insurrection for exactly the kind of behavior that we're seeing here. You have the left activists are all whipped up, and then you have people who are out there encouraging them to take action. And, you know, we've seen time and time and time again that what they call mostly peaceful protests is a euphemism they have to use, because mostly peaceful isn't entirely peaceful. And I should point out that you don't have to do anything violent in order to violate this law. You just need to try to intimidate or corruptly influence a judge. And I can assure you that if pro-life activists were demonstrating and protesting, no matter how peacefully, outside the home of, say, Justice Sotomayor or Justice Kagan, you would be hearing that this was a serious violation of federal law that the Justice Department had to prosecute.
Andy, let me shift gears just a little bit, because I haven't had a chance to ask you. The person that leaked the draft opinion, did they violate a law or just the rules of the court? And what do you think the outcome is? Because it's my understanding that Chief Justice Roberts did instruct the federal marshals to begin an investigation. I think we're going to figure out who that person was. But what type of justice do they face for doing such a thing?
Yeah, Kevin, I don't think there's any question that this is obstruction of justice. It's a corrupt act that's aimed at trying to influence the tribunal, which is a classic obstruction of justice. You know, we think of abortion as a public policy issue, but as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, it's a litigation. It's a case. So if you do a corrupt act, as was done here, with the objective of trying to change the outcome of what, you know, where the case appears to be going, that's obviously obstruction of justice.
I'm not alone in my opinion that the high court needs to get out of the mess it began almost 50 years ago now in Roe. The Alito majority draft decision, if it holds, is as encouraging as it is clear. Ken Klukowski served in the Justice Department with the Trump administration. He was a guest of Sebastian Gorka.
Is this an unusually good pre-decisional draft, or is this because it's Alito who's writing it?
Well, first of all, Justice Alito is a brilliant justice. His opinions are uniformly wonderful. But what you just described, and as I read it as well, it reminds me of the late Justice Scalia's opinion in District of Columbia versus Heller, which held that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is an individual right from 2008. That opinion was also almost exactly the same page length. That was a little over 60 pages. And what you saw there is what a well-written Supreme Court opinion is supposed to look like. This is an originalist decision, one that looks to the text, structure, and history of the Constitution. And in this case, in terms of looking at the history of a purported right to abortion, showing why this is in fact not a right found in the U.S. Constitution.
And then there's this fascinating moment where they jump from Roe to Casey, and they say that in Casey, they don't even try and argue what they said in Roe, the penumbra and everything else, and they know it's a garbage argument, so they go to the 14th Amendment. And even then, Alito says, well, I'm sorry, the 14th Amendment is clear that you've got to have some established tradition that accrues or connects to that right. And there is no established tradition in the Western canon of abortion. So even the Casey case is torn apart.
Yeah, I'll answer both parts of that. First, from Roe to Casey. You're right. Roe was a horribly written opinion. Arguably, there's not a single paragraph in that opinion that is actual legal reasoning, where you unpack the law and then apply it to facts. You get philosophical musings in there. They talk about ancient Greece and whatnot, stuff that has nothing to do with how you interpret the American Constitution. Yes. And so when the court in 1992, by a 5-4 vote, it chose not to overrule Roe v. Wade, which was from 1973, the court threw out everything in Roe, its trimester framework and all of this other stuff it had done, because Roe was just an embarrassing
I forgot to mention, yeah. And the trimester framework was just cut from whole cloth. They made up this trimester framework where the state has an interest, the state doesn't have an interest, and there was no legal justification. They just made it up.
That's right. That was Justice Blackmun, who said, looking back on his life, that he would rather have gone to med school than to law school. And so, you know, read into that what you will. But that's right. Understanding that that was a legally indefensible framework, they threw that out. And then Casey brought in what was a viability standard, that instead of three parts of a pregnancy, there's only two. There is before a child is viable outside the womb, and then after it's viable. And the issue of whether something is an undue burden on a woman seeking an abortion before viability, but that too proved to be a completely unworkable framework. And that was a big part of Justice Alito's opinion here. But to shift gears into the test that he applied then, the Supreme Court has developed for almost a century a framework for how you identify fundamental rights and how you also identify what are called implied rights, constitutional rights that are not found in the actual text of the Constitution, such as the right to have children, for example.
What happens now?
The justices in the majority have the authority, whenever they vote to do it, to just go ahead and release the opinion. And I would recommend doing so as quickly as possible so that we can all move forward. I believe that every day, every additional day that transpires between this decision becoming official and November's election day is that tens of millions of Americans are going to realize that the left has lied to them for half a century about what the effect of overruling Roe would be.
So I need you to help clarify something for me, because, again, it's been misrepresented that this is some, you know, one justice writing his opinion. No. It's not one justice writing his opinion. This is the first draft of the Supreme Court of the United States as their decision in the majority. And here, the last page is crucial. It's not one person's opinion. It's, quote, we now overrule Roe and Casey and return these authorities to the people and their elected representatives. The judgment of the Fifth Court is reversed. It is so ordered, are the last words.
Coming up, the president speaks out on inflation.
The mega Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress, which they have everything, they've done everything they can to slow down, that you're going to, will hand power over to them.
A town hall review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It's hard to know exactly how abortion politics will impact the November election. I'm of the opinion that it will pass from top of mind by the midterms, but not that it won't matter at all. But what will absolutely impact the election is inflation, soaring fuel prices, and a federal government that seems intent on doubling down on the policies that got us here, more spending. President Biden addressed the nation early this week.
The mega Republicans are counting on you to be as frustrated by the pace of progress, which they have everything, they've done everything they can to slow down, that you're going to, will hand power over to them.
Economist Stephen Moore joined Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson to talk about it. From AM 560, The Answer in Chicago.
The big eyes policies are working. The April numbers prove it. We're unwinding.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's just going swimmingly, isn't it? Look, that speech yesterday was just dreadful, really a dreadful speech in every way. I mean, one is that this is the president of the United States, and all he does is point fingers at everyone else but himself. You know, it's Putin, it's COVID, it's Trump, it's MAGA, it's all these things, you know. And when he came into office, the inflation rate was 1.5%, and we got some slight good news this morning that the inflation rate is now down from 8.5 to 8.3%. I guess we're supposed to celebrate that. But when he says he's bringing the deficit down, I mean, what planet is he living on? This is the guy who came in and the first thing he did was spend $3 trillion. You know, we had the $1.9 trillion, what they call it, the Recovery Act, and then the $1.1 trillion sham infrastructure bill, and it goes on and on. He just said last week he wants $1.5 trillion for student loan relief. He wants $30 billion unpaid for to send to Ukraine. I mean, I could go on and on with this stuff. He wants more. And by the way, that speech he gave yesterday was basically just endorsing the Build Back Better bill with more and more spending for solar. I mean, does anybody think that windmills are going to solve our inflation problem or even electric vehicles? Yeah, maybe in the year 2045, but this is 2022.
And he made that speech yesterday while I was speaking, gas prices hit an all-time record high.
Exactly. And by the way, I was thinking of you, Amy, the other day because I've been on the road. Speaking, and when I say, oh, you know, we have this 8% inflation problem, people get angry at me. They say, 8%? What are you talking about? My gas price is up 80%. My food prices are up 35%. You know, my travel costs are up 40%. The things that people have to buy every day aren't going at 8%, much higher than that. So I don't think a lot of people even believe these numbers. And you've been talking about how frustrated you are, you know, when you go to the store. And I think that's universal.
Well, it's going to be, I mean, diesel fuel is up almost $6 a gallon, and that's how our goods are delivered. So they're going to have to pass that on to the consumer.
You better believe it. And then you've got Biden saying that, he is going to solve this by more government spending and higher taxes. And incidentally, where did this line come from that the Republicans want this massive tax increase on the middle class? Meanwhile, we want to make the Trump tax cuts permanent. And Biden called for a big tax increase on quote the rich because the top 1% are going to pay for all this. They're going to reduce our $30 trillion debt. Right.
Well, you know, as the big guy famously said with the shovel ready projects in 2009, we have to keep spending money to prevent from going bankrupt. And so apparently that's still his philosophy.
Well, you know, the first step of a recovery is to admit you've got a problem.
This past Monday, Russia celebrated Victory Day, commemorating the Allied nations' victory over Germany and the Axis powers in the Second World War. Speculation over escalatory moves by Putin on that day did not materialize, but U.S. intelligence reports indicate that Putin is preparing for a long war. For an update, I turn to Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher.
How do you read that? What's that mean to you, Congressman Gallagher, on the Armed Services Committee and the Intel Committee in the House?
Well, I think since Vladimir Putin abandoned his original plan, which was sort of a blitzkrieg, fait accompli, we'll take Kyiv, we'll force the government in Ukraine to collapse, Zelensky will fold like a cheap suit. Obviously, that plan was built on a series of false assumptions. He has now really focused his attention on the south of the country and continues to shell in devastating fashion Mariupol and Odessa. And I think now he is dead set on maintaining effective control of the southern part of the country so as to establish a land bridge from Crimea to Russia and have total dominance of the Black Sea. Now, perhaps you might think that's not as bad as him taking over all of the country, and it isn't, but it's still absolutely devastating to the country and the people of Ukraine. And I don't see Putin turning and retreating back to Russia anytime soon. So we have to remain steadfast in our support of Zelensky, which is why I think it was a good move to support this enhanced assistance bill to Ukraine that we passed. I know the overall number, the sticker shock, scared a lot of people. But keep in mind, less than $10 billion of that is going directly to the Ukrainians. I would submit they have proven that they can use those weapons we're giving them very well. And anytime you have our partners on the ground at a very low cost destroying Russian warships, I think that's a good investment geopolitically. That's an investment in our own security over the long term. And the rest of that money, the overwhelming majority of the rest, goes to us, to our defense industrial base, to help replenish our stockpiles. And one of the biggest things that concerns me right now, Hugh, is that we are going Winchester on a lot of key missile systems that we're not only going to need in Ukraine, we're going to need for the Taiwan fight. We went through
Wait, Congressman, going Winchester, would you explain that?
Basically expending all your rounds, firing everything in your arsenal.
So that's actually what Trump inherited when he came in. The shelf was bad. Jim Mattis said that. There just wasn't anything to spend or shoot. So how quickly can the United States replenish its stocks?
Well, here's the problem. On a lot of these missile systems, Hugh, they have so-called long lead items. Basically, 30% of the components of a missile system require a lot of time to get compiled and then constructed into a missile. So we have to change the way that we buy these missiles in order to stockpile them effectively, moving towards a model where you're basically buying multiple sets of long lead items at a time anytime you buy a single missile system, so that you can move faster in terms of your overall production and stockpile. It's something I'm pressing the Defense Department to do.
You know, drawing the wrong lessons from a war is always a danger. The 1991 quick march in Kuwait gave us an overwhelming sense of superiority that maybe led us to hubris, which, excuse me, maybe led us into Iraq. What wrong lessons might we draw from this?
The foremost wrong lesson that we could draw is that in order to deter a thug or a totalitarian dictator, whether he is in Moscow or Beijing, we can rely solely on soft power. Soft power is not sufficient to deter.
Last question, Congressman Gallagher. It looks like a static front is developing, something like World War I with much bigger bombs and much better artillery. Is that your assessment? Can they get to Odessa?
My honest assessment is I don't know. I think because Putin has no regard for human life,
right,
and is committed to a war of attrition, I think he will make slow, incremental gains. And if I had to guess, I would say yes, notwithstanding the bravery of the Ukrainian forces. Although we're about to give them a massive infusion of assistance, they've proven quite nimble, resilient, capable, and I think they can at least impose enormous costs on the Russians as they try and march towards Odessa. We could see this evolving into something of a frozen conflict. I mean, ask yourself, Hugh, did the Syrian war ever really end? A war that Russia was intensely involved in? No. Slaughter continues to this day. We could see something similar happen to Ukraine, and that would be a tragedy.
Coming up, Rand Paul is not particularly keen on the Disinformation Governance Board, the DGB. Sounds a lot like the KGB.
You think the American people are so stupid they need you to tell them what the truth is?
When the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, friends. This is Katie Pavlich from townhall.com. The liberal media and big tech are working overtime to promote the left's anti-American agenda and silence me and the reporters on our team at Town Hall. We have to bring the truth to the American people, free from the spin of big media and the censorship of those big tech companies. We're constantly covering the news that matters, exposing the COVID lies, the leftist rot and crime surge in our cities, the illegal alien crisis at our southern border, and all of Joe Biden's unconstitutional overreach, including the critical race theory attacks on our children and grandchildren by school boards and the Department of Justice. I hope you'll support our vital team of conservative journalists today. You can do so by going to townhallaction.com. While cancel culture and big tech comes for us, the direct support of our VIP members helps make us uncancelable. Please join our team by becoming a VIP member at townhallaction.com. That's townhallaction.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. You have to wonder how the Biden administration stumbled into this whole mess with the launch of the Disinformation Governance Board. Even political novices find it alarming that the Department of Homeland Security would use its vast powers to police truth. Anyone with a bit of familiarity with history see it as eerily Orwellian. Senator Rand Paul didn't mince words at a Senate hearing with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas.
Think of all the debates and disputes we've had over the last 50 years in our country. We work them out by debating them. We don't work them out by the government being the arbiter. I don't want your guardrails. I want you to have nothing to do with speech. You think we can't determine, you know, speech by traffickers is disinformation? You think the American people are so stupid they need you to tell them what the truth is? You can't even admit what the truth is with the Steele dossier. I don't trust government to figure out what the truth is.
The Kentucky senator was a guest of that other Mike Gallagher.
You must be disgusted and mortified with the efforts by the federal government to regulate speech in America.
Even if we could agree on what disinformation is, I'd be against regulating it because I'm for freedom. I'm for the allowing the individual to make their case, right or wrong. And I think people are smart enough to determine the truth. I mean, I gave him the example of disinformation, Russian disinformation, that the FBI now concludes that Christopher Steele was spreading Russian disinformation. CNN, by propagating this for 2 years, that somehow Trump was colluding with Russia, which was disinformation spread by Russia. CNN was colluding to do this as well. They were propagating this. But I'm not for telling CNN that they can't propagate disinformation. I think people are smart enough to change the channel. In fact, millions and millions of Americans have changed the channel from CNN. But the thing is, the idea that the government can figure this out, Mayorkas would not even admit, even though the FBI concluded that the dossier was Russian disinformation, he wouldn't admit. He says he wasn't familiar with the topic. And I'd say, really? We spent $32 million on this and you're not familiar with the topic?
I mean, it's chilling. And I ask this question almost daily here on this radio show. How did we get here? How did we get to a point where certain conversations are simply not permitted? COVID, you're not allowed to talk about a natural immunity online. That gets you shut down. You're not allowed to question what the so-called scientists and experts are telling us. And look at election integrity. This is an issue that's so important to millions of Americans, Senator. We've been talking a lot this week about Dinesh D'Souza's movie, 2,000 Mules. You know, you may disagree with the premise. You may not think that there were mules and the ability to track them from nonprofits to drop boxes in the middle of the night, sometimes wearing gloves. It was all captured on surveillance. Guess what? At least have the conversation. You can have a dialogue about it, can't you?
Well, it's not a free society if you can't make your case or you're not allowed to make your case. If we're going to edit speech, that's just not freedom as any of us know it. But the irony is that there used to be people on the left who actually did believe in freedom of speech. This was something that brought libertarians on the right together with civil libertarians on the left. And there was a great defense of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. There were these coalitions. But the left has largely abandoned their civil liberty sort of root, their libertarian roots. And the left now is becoming more and more authoritarian. They are afraid of speech. They want to regulate speech. But there are people on the right that want to do this, too. So when we talk about the disinformation board, we have to realize that there are proposals in Congress from Republicans to have boards that will determine speech and regulate big tech and say, oh, this speech can or cannot be done because it's going to be regulated by government. I'm much more for the Wild West. There's lots of information out there. There are millions or at least tens of thousands of choices you can look towards. And really, change the channel. You don't like that opinion. You don't think they're telling the truth. Change the channel, whether it's radio, whether it's the internet, or whether it's television. There are more choices now than there have ever been. But we do have to be worried if government's going to get involved in this space.
Quickly, Elon Musk confirming yesterday that if and when he gets control of Twitter, he's going to welcome Trump back to Twitter. Oh, look at this. Jack Dorsey now supports Trump returning to Twitter. The ACLU supports reinstating Donald Trump. Where were all those folks for the last 2 years, Senator?
All I can say is, you know, I've been threatening and threatening to quit Twitter, and I've quit YouTube because they censor me, but I haven't quit Twitter. But if Elon Musk takes over, gets rid of the censors, I love his irreverent sarcasm, and he's actually just plain funny a lot of the times. And actually, I don't even know his politics. I think he may have a libertarian streak to him, but yeah. I don't think he's either conservative or liberal. I think he's probably a mixture of a lot of different beliefs that the younger generation believes in that I might not always agree with. But my goodness, do I agree with freedom of speech without question? I think he's going to make it a fun place again. But yep. You know what? I doubt Trump will come back. You know, he's a direct competitor now. They've got a bunch of money invested in this Truth Social. So I would be very surprised if he came back to Twitter.
Coming up, Elon Musk in the critical role of big tech.
Elon Musk stepped in an unprecedented fashion for a private company. repositioned Starlink satellites, and then sent within 24 hours of the invasion uplink terminals so that Ukraine and President Zelensky could remain connected to the Internet.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. It's a look at today's most compelling stories and provides responses from key conservatives in media and politics. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It's too soon to tell how Putin's unprovoked war on Ukraine will turn out, but it's not too soon to recognize that Ukraine has defied virtually all expectation. Yes, they've had help. Your mind might go immediately to weapons, but Elon Musk's Starlink services were enormous. Indeed, Russia recognized it and issued a death threat on the world's richest man. I turn to my friend, former colleague, and national security advisor under Donald Trump, Robert C. O'Brien.
Tell me, what did you think of a Russian official threatening an American citizen?
Well, this is a very serious issue, especially in light of the fact that Russia has a history of assassinating its opponents. And so the FBI is almost certainly consulted with Elon. There's a duty to warn that the FBI has for American citizens who've been threatened by foreign governments. And unfortunately, you know, it happens more and more with China, Iran, now Russia getting into this game of threatening Americans. So Elon, I'm sure, has great security. He can certainly afford it. But the U.S., because of Elon's role in the Ukraine crisis and the great work that his companies have done, really ought to be thinking about supplementing his security, at least giving them daily intelligence feeds and potentially giving him government security to work with his private folks. I mean, this is a very serious threat.
Very serious threat. And it also underscores that what Elon Musk did was significant. I mean, he may be nominated for a Nobel Prize next year because I think he helped save Ukraine. What do you think of my assessment there?
Well, he should be, because Ukraine is winning the information war in this war. And the reason it's winning is because of the United States of America and specifically U.S. private sector tech companies. And there are two big reasons, Hugh. First is Musk and Starlink. What he did was unprecedented. As you know, in the early days, the early day or two of the war, Russia tried to use its technical capabilities to take Ukraine off the Internet and to prevent Zelensky, President Zelensky, and the Ukrainians from communicating with the outside world. Elon Musk stepped in an unprecedented fashion for a private company, repositioned Starlink satellites, and then sent within 24 hours of the invasion uplink terminals so that Ukraine and President Zelensky would remain connected to the Internet. I don't think there's a similar example of a private sector company outside of a Marvel movie with a character doing that in real life. It's amazing what he did.
And you know, he is the Tony Stark of the private sector, and a Medal of Freedom would be at least a Medal of Freedom, because he really did. That matters. Technology matters so much in this war, correct?
Oh, 100%. Imagine this war if Ukraine was not connected to the outside world via the Internet. And the second shout out I'll give, and I've been very critical of U.S. social media companies on your show and others, as you know, Hugh, over the years, but it's U.S. social media platforms that then allowed Zelensky to use that Internet link up with Starlink to get the message out, to show the war crimes, the targeting of civilians, the resilience of the Ukrainian people. And it's, you know, the Facebook and Google and Twitter, which Elon may own soon, and all these other social media platforms that got the message out to the whole world. And it did two things. Number one, it galvanized the West and it galvanized Europe. But number two, there were a lot of countries that were either neutral or sympathetic to Putin and Russia that may not have put this information out, but they couldn't avoid it because their people were watching what was happening on social media. So between Elon providing the Internet access and the Ukrainians taking advantage of social media platforms that have worldwide reach, Ukraine has won this information war. It's really astounding. So, you know, a lesson here is we need to be careful about what we do with big tech, notwithstanding our legitimate concerns, because, you know, breaking up big tech would have left the People's Republic of China and their massive Internet companies, TikTok and others, which have been very helpful to the Russians and censored for the Russians. that would have allowed them to control the worldwide global information space. And can you imagine how different Ukraine would look if you were watching the war on TikTok as opposed to American social media platforms?
This is in stark relief, and therefore I wanted to talk about it with you. I am a huge critic of big tech because of the censorship that they have practiced domestically. On the other hand, I've also said, don't run off and bring a Sherman Antitrust Act against it. That's a blunt instrument. That is not a regulatory approach to the problems that ail big tech. Number one, the private sector is acting. You know, Elon Musk is itself the private sector working to correct Twitter's errors. But I am curious, do you think that the old antitrust laws ought to be force fit, you know, square peg and round holes or vice versa to address big tech? I think we need new legislation and new rules.
So I agree with you, Hugh, and I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal back in December, and it got a lot of attention. You know, breaking up big tech with antitrust tools is a very blunt instrument, and number one, it would be terrible for the information space, but number two, these companies have scale, and the only way we can stay in competition with the Chinese, and the Chinese Communist Party is pumping hundreds of billions of dollars every year into their AI, quantum computing, machine learning, all these technologies of the future, the U.S. still has an edge, and that's why I'm confident that the U.S. is going to prevail in big power competition. But the edge doesn't come from the government. It doesn't come from government research programs or government bureaucracies. The edge comes from these large U.S. private sector companies that have the scale to do the research and the innovation that keep us in the game. And think about SpaceX, another Elon Musk situation. If it wasn't for SpaceX, we'd still be reliant on the Russians to get American astronauts down from the space station during this war. Can you imagine the leverage they'd have on us? We don't have that problem because Elon Musk, you know, cut through the bureaucracy of the big defense contractors and NASA and developed a way to get us to space. Jeff Bezos is doing the same thing, and there are other U.S. companies are doing. We've got a renaissance in space because of the private sector. So we've got to be very careful about using the blunt instruments of antitrust with Republican conservatives joining up with Amy Klobuchar and Chuck Schumer to destroy American businesses. We need to regulate those businesses. There's no question about it. The censorship and the bias in big tech against conservatives, you know, has to be fixed. It's a real concern. It's not a fake concern. It's a real concern. But we've got to be careful how we do it so we don't destroy these great national treasures and assets of this country.
Why is Silicon Valley, you're California, why are they so tone deaf? I mean, Mark is the only guy who has reached out to actually hear, to talk to serious conservatives about these issues. Silicon Valley's in a deep blue bubble. It is tone deaf.
Well, it's in California, and it's a bubble in California. And, it's fed by, you know, my former university, my law school, Berkeley, and your school, Harvard, and Stanford, and the elites control these places. And so folks come into those companies with a bias already. But I think you're starting to see a revolt even in Silicon Valley. You've got folks like Peter Thiel and Blake Masters, who's running for Senate now in Arizona as a conservative. You've got Elon Musk, who's a libertarian. So I think you're starting to see a diversity of opinion.
There's more to that conversation. Catch the full interview at townhallreview.com. Coming up, protesting and preparing for protests within houses of worship.
The fact that our practice of our religious conscience couldn't happen without men with guns securing that church.
Sebastian Gorka in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Georgine Rice. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Protesters threaten the homes and families of Supreme Court justices.
I don't have an official U.S. government position on where people protest.
Is the administration encouraging illegal activity?
Section 1507 makes it a federal crime.
Are we really about to witness the overturn of Roe versus Wade?
Sometimes I think Christians can be cynical and think everything's terrible, everything's bad.
The prospect of an end to Roe has led to violence at pro-life pregnancy resource centers.
There was an individual around our offices who had two Molotov cocktails.
And school parents in Virginia get a victory in court.
You know, I mean, where do you even start on this Loudoun County School Board?
Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The fallout to the release of the draft opinion from the Supreme Court
has had an impact well beyond the protests at the homes of Supreme Court justices. Pro-life pregnancy centers have been vandalized, and Catholic churches were threatened with interruptions of their services last week on Mother's Day. Sebastian Gorka explains.
I went to a parish which is, let's just say, connected to the Supreme Court in a certain way. And it was great to be there because it was full. And out of the hundreds of people there, lots of children, lots of families. As I sat there, I looked around. The first thing I noticed was the number of ushers, most of them large individuals, parishioners, but ushers. The fact that our practice of our religious conscience couldn't happen without men with guns securing that church, peace officers in uniform with openly carried weapons, with parishioners with concealed weapons, securing the families, the young children, the babies that were in that church. Well, that tells you where we are today. The fact that the homes of Supreme Court associate justices are being picketed, that Justice Alito and his family have had to be removed by the authorities and taken to a safe, undisclosed location because of the credible threats to their lives from people who aren't satisfied with 60 million aborted babies. I'm not interested with so-called conservatives saying, oh, this is a distraction. Don't you understand? It's about CRT. It's about the border. It's about inflation, the price of gas. It's about baby formula. Wrong. You are utterly wrong. Those are the manifestations of a deeper spiritual conflict, a war for the soul, not of just this nation, but of our civilization. And a civilization is measured by how it treats the most vulnerable in its society, the aged, the children, and most especially the unborn. Wake up, America.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch the full set of comments from Sebastian at our website, townhallreview.com. If you like our podcast, take a moment, please, to give us a glowing 5-star review. Be sure you're subscribed as well. If you haven't signed up yet, take that moment to do so. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schumann, producers David Pichon, Michael Cook, Ben Brigman, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, Jacob Orduña, and Dash Bong Bong Patterson. Let me say once again thanks to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.